Council of Ministers met the people this week, and after a few teething problems with the first session, the initiative was generally considered a positive one. So what did they learn? Did they listen? Will policies and strategies change following the feedback received? No doubt time will be the best judge as to how meaningful this exercise actually was. Later, we'll hear from Ministers Poole, Wilson and Barber, but first Christian Jones talked to a range of people at the events, and this is what some people at the Western event had to say.
I'm Richard. I'm here to speak to Alfred Cannon about a number of concerns I have and the Treasury about regarding the tax increases and further tax increases that I see are to come.
I feel it's my duty and obligation to keep in touch with what's going on. I don't expect all my fellow commissioners to be here, but I think some of us should be here to get a feel for what's happening in the big wide world. I've one or two pointed questions and I've posed some of them. Whether I get the answer I want or whether I get the answer that the politicians think I want, I don't know. But it's up to me to decide and to make a judgment on that. No, I'm... Since I've become a commissioner, I've become much more democratic. Before I was a commissioner, I was very self-opinionated and self-effacing. Now I'm much more liberal and try to see the other man's point of view.
Treasury over there is being swarmed.
Yes.
Is that surprising?
Not at all. He won't solve all the problems tonight. He won't answer all the questions. What I do think, what's wrong in the Isle of Man at the moment, I think there are too many holes in the bucket. There's too much money leaching away and not enough effort. You know, I don't mean to be patronising to you, but I'm going back, 50 years ago, when there were people in the House of Keys then who were committed and done a very good job of putting money into the reserves. And we've been trading on that ever since. I know the health service say that they ask for more money every year. They say that the health service could run away with the whole budget on its own every year. Now, I know that, but the money has to come from somewhere. It has to come from somewhere. I do wonder how much effort has been made into putting some shekels back in the tin. There's one or two issues that are personal to me. I do wonder how much money the Peggy has cost us so far. It's languishing in one of the most expensive warehouses on the Isle of Man up at Goldsmithy. And there's a nurse on the radio not many weeks ago, trying to get a job in the Isle of Man. She can't get anywhere to live. If you take those two equations, they're not right, are they? There's a cruise ship came into Douglas yesterday. There was only about 300 passengers on it, but they gave the itinerary. And part of it was to go to Craignish. Now, to me, Craignish is an embarrassment. The other thing was to go pick litter off the beach. If you're going on a cruise, is that part of your itinerary? I won't solve all those things tonight, but I want the politicians to know that we are taking an interest in these things. We just don't accept what goes on and do nothing. Too many people, I think, do that. I think. I was serious disappointment last week. I called at the Horstram stables and I was told by the stables foreman that the public are not allowed into the stables now because the politicians can't agree what to do with the tramway terrace in front of the stables. And they say it's a liability and that's why they won't allow the public in. A lot of these problems would go away, I think, with a little bit of common sense.
Yeah, so we came here today because we've got businesses based in Peel, so it's nice to always see or hear what the government are actually actioning or willing to do or provide assistance for, especially in Peel, because I do feel Peel is a very liked place in the island, but I do feel it's a very left behind place in the island. I don't know if that's the commissioners or the government or whoever falls on, but we personally, I'm here for my company and I've got a handful of things from assistance to help with certain new lines we're trying to start, and then also I'm looking to just speak to another one to do with employment because we're still struggling with employment. The Isle of Man obviously has a very low employment rate, but still you're expected to go through all the rigmarole. We've got visas, so I brought people over on visas. Last year I brought over 15 half of them were on three-year visas and half of them were on seasonal visas. The only reason I got seasonal visas is because the government kind of enforced it on us with the alluring assistance and, to provide assistance financially. Whereas now, we're 9 months down the line having to renew their visas and they're making us have to jump through hoops and we maybe have to send them back. So our job is a skilled job in my eyes, whereas it's classed as a non-skilled job, and that needs to be changed. There is no way you can walk into the job we do and within a couple of days be able to do the job. It takes months, up to about 6 months to train someone, and it's just unfair to know that you've spent thousands of pounds bringing people over, tens of thousands of pounds, to then just be expected to go, well, you need to take someone from the Isle of Man who's unskilled and is nothing compared to the people you've put through all the training. So that's the main reason I'm here.
Some voices from the Western listening session. Next, the East.
So my name's Roy Duggan. I've been in catering for over 30-odd years. I'm here today for the meeting just because it's an industry which is literally on its arse right now. It's really struggling. I've never seen it as bad as the way it currently is. I'm seeing people, businesses closing, every couple of months, which is painful to watch. And I'm here to pitch what I said before. If we're really going to support Manx, and we're crying out for this 0% VAT, why don't we go a bit more than the Manx menu idea and stuff like that, and we should have 0% VAT for any products that we use, which is over 70% of Manx ingredients. Why don't we have that? Because it's a lot broader than just the short-lived Manx menu thing, and it bolsters the economy, because it's not just impacting me, it's impacting your farmer, your milk provider, and all of them services.
Just purely curiosity, really, to see them all in their feathers and see how they answer the questions, to be honest. The only one I was curious about is the World Health Organization's agenda to try and get me to sign up to their pandemic treaty. That's the only thing I would be worried about.
The Isle of Man is the sixth oldest population in the world, and we basically want to come to speak to the politicians and kind of help, hopefully get them to address this kind of issue for us, because we found that because they pay poverty wages, we can't get a house. Yeah, well, it's as simple as that. And every year the dependency ratio increases and they don't seem to be remedying it any way whatsoever. 50% of 18-year-olds leave straight away. I spoke to the Department of Enterprise. They don't seem to be having any initiatives in to really try and draw people back. There's a few token gestures, but nothing serious. And then the wages, I spoke to Alex Allenson, and I said, the UK's just raised their minimum wage and they haven't done it here, or they're planning not to. There's been a big kickoff and they're possibly going to raise it. But yeah, just it seems to be that they don't care about young people. And we all know it's expensive to live on the Isle of Man. The cost of living has been going up everywhere. But it's the opportunities, it's the opportunity to travel. I swear the steam packet is one of the examples, because everyone talks about privatisation within the train system in the UK. And interestingly, they've deprivatised the steam packet and somehow the prices seem to have gone up. It beggars belief, really. So, all these things, we want to leave the island and travel. We're at that kind of age where we want to do that. Can't even get off. Some of it's situational from the weather, but for the most part, it's just extortionate. And yeah, just want to be able to leave. I want to be able to pay my rent. I want to be able to get a decent wage. I don't want to be getting paid poverty wages by the Isle of Man government, which I work for. That's it, really. It's, simple as that.
Yeah, I work in a fairly sort of niche job, I suppose. I work for the government as well. I work for the Manx language school. So I am a Manx language speaker. And yeah, I'm still on a 0 hours contract. There's nothing you can do about that. Easter is 2 weeks off. Christmas is 2 weeks off. And then the summer holidays is 6 weeks unpaid leave, essentially, and non-negotiable. You have to do that. And I'm still paying my rent, the offset, I suppose. I'm still paying my rent from last summer's summer holidays. I work a second job. I work in hospitality, and so I have no free days. I work Monday to Friday at the school, and I work Thursday and Friday, sometimes Saturday, in the pub as well. And luckily, I'm renting off a friend's parents, so my rent is very, very low. But we've looked for places. It's like $6.50 per person to rent. On the Isle of Man is sort of the cheapest.
A Dandara new house is $1,200 a month, and that's a new build. It's still a two up, two down in somewhere like Riyadh, and they all outclass my wage. I work a regular 60-hour week job most weeks. I do 8 till 5 or 8 till 6 most of the time. It's hard graft. It's metalworking. After tax, there's no money in it. I mean, $6.50 a month for a room with a simple utility like a shower and a bathroom and a small kitchenette wipes me out of all of my funds. And then you can forget about having money set aside for a rainy day or any kind of savings. It's just impossible.
It's essentially, if you want to rent as a single person, it's just impossible, basically. Yeah. Like, maybe if you work in the finance sector or whatever and you get paid more than this, but as a government job and for my pal's job here, it's just, yeah, you could live there, but then you can't do anything fun. So you can either work and live there but then have no life, or live with your parents, or move away from the Isle of Man, because Australia, yeah, loads of people go off to Australia, don't they? But it can't be done. The sort of work-life ratio can't be done. I'd say it's probably the main reason that anyone who comes back after uni, they stay on the Isle of Man because they're, oh yeah, well, I love the Isle of Man, I want to live here, but then you can't afford it. As a young person, you can't afford it.
So I take a bit of umbrage with the amount of abandoned properties that I find on this island. If I take a small village, for example, like St. John's, off the top of my head, I can think of 4 separate buildings and then building complexes which have been abandoned for, I think the shortest one, about 8 years. There is the old beautiful Manxstone cottage down by that Greva River on the Curragh's Road. That has been abandoned since I was about 12 years old. Since then, I've watched the roofs collapse, the windows get smashed in, and it's all just left. Again, another building that someone like myself with manual skills and practical skills would love to be able to buy if it was affordable and do up, take the time, that would be no issue. You know, good things come to those who wait. But there never seems to be an opportunity for those properties to arrive on the market. And when they do, they are extortionate. They are far outclassed for individuals like myself. They are clearly for some other professional to come in and pay someone else to come and do it. We were discussing this earlier. We found about, 4 in Peel? Yeah, they've been abandoned for years. Half of them, the floors have come in, the windows are gone, and they're either not on the market or maybe they've got plans for it but don't have the money or funds to act on it. But in which case, surely there needs to be some kind of limit to how long one of these properties can be owned and allowed to fall into utter abandonment and disrepair before eventually it's bulldozed and replaced with another Dandara estate with houses down at Riyadh Mai for $1,200 a month, completely unaffordable for anyone like myself.
I wanted to hear what the government ministers had to say about government affairs and to hear what questions the audience asked of the ministers.
I just want to hear from the Treasury what they were going to do to support people who are first-time buyers, because as current renters, we're looking to, you know, go onto the property ladder and so forth. That's what you're meant to do, but it is hard at the moment as we're kind of sort of a squeezed middle in terms of we both work full-time, me and my partner, and yet, you know, we're being asked to save up, you know, something like, you know, 30 grand for a deposit. And at the moment, even though we are saving regularly, that is still quite a big ask. And that is something that's quite difficult. And we were just asking the Treasury then, what support is there basically in getting their response to the matter? I think there's now a generational thing on the islands. And so it's a bigger question, not just how do we help young people out or, you know, younger people, but how do we even, bigger pitch, how do we keep them on the islands for, you know, so that they can then raise their families on the islands, so forth in a couple of years' time? Because with the way house prices are, it might be that actually going across is a lot more affordable and they just find work there instead.
Firstly, it was with house prices and the idea that there is not a lot of support for people, couples like we are, who are professionals, who have gone to university, become educated to fill those jobs with education and health and so on. And they're not there's not enough support out there, and what the government are doing about it, because they keep saying that they are going to put things in, they're putting things in place, but no action has been seen, and they're now in their nearly third year of their tenure before the next election. And I know a lot of my friends who are from the island have moved away because they can't afford to be here and there are better jobs elsewhere. And my second issue was within education, with working in education, actually what are they doing to help reform the department to retain teachers on the island, because we do get better offers if we decide to move abroad, but what are they doing to keep us here along with Treasury to retain us? Otherwise, they're going to have a middle generation who will be gone by a certain point. We see ourselves looking elsewhere. We've had job offers from abroad, and we've also had job offers from the UK that are more, that give us a better idea of what we could afford, and sometimes even a better lifestyle. Even though the Isle of Man offers so much, it's not always given its full potential, and given this generation the potential that it could be.
After the break, we'll hear from the North. Finally, this is what the people from the North thought of listening to you, Comyn's recent exercise in finding out what people think.
Well, we own a shop on Parliament Street, Shalley Gift Shop, so we just thought it'd be useful to come along tonight and just hear what people have to say about Ramsey and see if it affects our business and whatnot.
And do you have anyone in particular that you want to talk to or are interested in any questions?
Honestly, no, not really. I'm just interested in like everyone's opinion and what everyone has to say.
And what's your opinion?
Honestly, I don't really have one. I'm just here to sit and listen, honestly. I don't live in Ramsey. I live in Peel as well. I just work in Ramsey.
Okay.
But yeah.
That's great. Thank you.
Because of the state of our roads, they're horrendous. We were out cycling on Sunday, and how we didn't come off, we'll never know.
So have you spoken to the Infrastructure Minister?
Yeah, he's taking all good notes, so let's see what happens. But, I mean, there's one thing that really I just can't understand. 2 years ago, they put traffic calming measures in Balagh instead of the lollipop man. They actually reversed into our adopted road to work on it and left the three holes. I reported it 2 years later. We've still got holes in St Mary's Meadow at the stop sign, and they're getting deeper and deeper, and people are falling in them and hurting themselves all the time. And they actually drove in to work on that section of road.
So we're here just to question why the minimum wage is increasing but the tax threshold isn't, because it's absolutely stinging us, isn't it? I work for this lady on a minimum wage, and I've also had to take on a second job, and it's just not even viable to do that now. So it's like just be even more skint. That's my situation at the moment. Like, it's some weeks it's to the point where I'm living on beans, toast, but like I've got to be so careful what I'm buying, because if my car breaks, I don't have spare cash for that car to fix it, and then I can't get to work and I can't do my job. And I just don't understand, if you're increasing the wages, why isn't the tax threshold increased? I'm asking you. Tell me now!
Yeah, I'm here as a business owner, not in hospitality, completely different, doggy daycare. And
yeah, also not hospitality.
Basically, I want to know why the government are putting the taxes up, the wages are up, but the self-employed are then, like me, where kind of, it feels like I'm getting punished for working 50, 60 hours just to feed myself and try and pay wages. There's no help. Gone to the Department of Enterprise, they can't help me. There's no help. And all these little businesses are closing down because the government just aren't helping us. They're just trying to, it's like we're getting punished for working. Like, I think I'd be better off on the dole, and I would do. And there's no and again, I was saying before, there's no incentive for these people that are on the dole to go to work, because they're getting paid more to not work. And yeah, basically, I just want to know how the government going to help us and why are they just putting everything up and not doing anything to help small businesses, employed people, self-employed people, just everybody really, except for the rich, because they only seem to be helping the rich people. And yeah, that's it.
Thank you so much.
Getting angry.
You wish you never sat here.
I know.
We came to speak to Tim Johnson, who's the Enterprise Minister, regarding an issue we've got with photography for the TT. A couple of photographers that usually supply us have indicated they may not be able to supply us with pictures this year because of an issue with licensing. And we came to clear that up with Tim Johnson. Hopefully, we're going to get something resolved. At first, it seemed that the government were quite happy to stop local businesses from making something out of the TT. And anyway, we're assured that that's not the case and that they will sort this out. So that's why we came to see Tim Johnson.
TT's not that long away. Do you have confidence that that will be resolved by TT?
I'm hoping it will be resolved by tomorrow. I've been assured it will. So, no, once they have cleared it up and then we can pass on the information to the photographer that he can supply us, and then things were already in hand, so hopefully yes.
We're going live on this?
No, it's pre-recorded.
All right, have we got all this?
Yeah.
You'll right. be on the radio,
My name's Richard Hardman. My daughter runs the Grove and the Pub in Andreas, and we've come here tonight to see if we can get some help with the finances. The pub is one of the best on the island, I think, biased, and we're really struggling. It looks as if we're making a lot of money, but we're not, because there's so many overheads and costs going out. The VAT is killing us, the National Insurance is killing us, and we don't know whether we'll be able to carry on. Well, next few months will tell. We'll give it to after TT, and then we'll have to have a think about it. But other than that,
My name's Julia Bell. I came here tonight to the Roadshow in Ramsey to speak particularly to the Department of Education, Sports and Culture, so Minister Kane, Daphne Kane. The reason for coming was because I've created an advocacy group for Dyslexia Advocacy Group IOM. That's what we're called. And our group, we meet every fortnight on a Wednesday at the Family Library, and we are trying to work with the Department of Education and with third sector organisations to improve identification and provision for children in mainstream education who have or suspect they have dyslexia or dyscalculia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, because we feel like these children, unfortunately, are not being identified and not being given the best provision. We feel like there needs to be improvement in this area. Like, so for example, my personal circumstance is that my daughter wasn't identified as having dyslexia. I identified it, and I had to really kind of convince the school that there was a problem, and my concerns weren't really recognised. So I had to take her to the UK to pay for a diagnosis privately, and you know, it cost me a lot of money. And then it was only then that with kind of ink on paper that I was able to say, take it to the school and say, look, she has got dyslexia. I paid for the diagnostic assessment and it says she has. And even then I was kind of, I struggled with thwarted hope, because the report, which offered recommendations, weren't really being implemented. So it was constant fight to try and get the schools to implement support for her. So,
what brought you along tonight?
Oh, I just wanted to have the opportunity to speak to my respective ministers about certain things on the island and stuff like that.
Is there any issue in particular that you've brought to them?
If I had to be brutally honest, I'd say the housing crisis that's engulfing the island at the moment.
And how old are you at the moment?
I am currently 15 and a half.
So you'll be looking to go to university after you finish school?
I'm certainly considering it. I want to be an MHK when I'm older, so I'm thinking of the best path I should take at the moment. I think it'd be really good.
So you are obviously intending to come and live back on the island after you've finished your education?
Oh, of course, yes. The Isle of Man is a great place. It's a great place to invest in. Amazing.
I just want to say it's a huge honour to be on Manx Radio. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
The main reason for coming is to see if we can change the way in which the government accounts, particularly with regards to the provision of services through the Department of Health and Social Care and Manx Care. Because at the moment, everything, if it's a large value item, is booked in the year in which it's purchased, takes no account of the life of the item. So it could well be that there's a very high value item which over 10 years would save twice its cost, but cannot be purchased because of the hit to the account in the year in which it's purchased. So it would be far better charging a set amount each year of the life of the item, so it wouldn't have a massive effect on the revenue budget of DHSC and Manx Care in the year of purchase.
And have you spoken to Mr. Hooper?
No, I actually went to the Treasury Minister because Mr. Hooper was busy at the time, so I spoke to Dr. Allinson about it. He didn't sound too confident that he would be able to change the mindset, but he is aware of the potential benefits that could accrue.
And do you reckon you'll ask Mr. Hooper during the question time?
Well, they're both Ramsey MHKs, they talk to each other, so I have no doubt that they will have a conversation about it.
So, as a Manx resident, I came over in 97, and I feel that the island had a lot more to offer years ago when there was less people to what's actually available to the local communities, but also visitors that want to come to the island. And I feel that the proposals for the strategy isn't realistic with the actual infrastructures that we have at present in housing, in policing, social care, and I think it needs to be discussed in a transparent way where people can ask, not fearful, and also get answers that are actually honest and truthful.
So when the island plan was published and you found out that they had an intention of creating 5,000 new jobs and subsequently that would bring the island's population to around 100,000, what was your action?
I don't necessarily think it's about population, it's about what amenities are on the island, what the infrastructure is like, about the actual Manx people, because I feel like you're losing your Manx culture. I went to Wales last week, all you see is Manx sign language with English interpretation. They're very passionate about the people, and I feel sometimes the Manx don't have their voice, and it is their home at the end of the day.
Well, what brought me along tonight is that I'm at the moment licensed sitting for my son in the Mitre Hotel in Ramsey. And I was at the one in Douglas. I used to be in charge, I used to be the chairman of the Isle of Man Licensed Fixers Association a couple of years ago. But what worries me is the fact that, and worries all of the hospitality. Hospitality is on its knees, and that's right across the board. People cannot go on losing money. And they are losing money. And I mean losing money quite considerably. There's no net profit anymore. People can take more money, but the overheads of gas, electricity, all fuels, licensing, taxes, it's all becoming very prohibitive on businesses, and they cannot keep it up. Can't get staff. Staff costs have gone up. The minimum wage has gone up considerably. You can't do all that to an industry that's all on its knees. And something has to be done. And these people, very grateful for the chance to come along and talk to our representatives, which you can't do in the UK, but the Isle of Man is unique. But they must take these thoughts away and work on it. We need something before this industry disintegrates, and it will do.
Some quite worrying testament from people who spoke to Christian at the Listening to You event. So what did the ministers make of it? Deputy Chief Minister Jane Poole-Wilson and DEFA Minister Claire Barber attended the event. I suppose from both of you, I'll start with you, Jane, an initial reaction to how things went. Were you surprised by the comments or were you pretty much expecting what you heard?
I think it was. I think we all found it very valuable, actually, and certainly the feedback we got on the different nights was that I think the people who came found it valuable as well. I think it was a good opportunity actually to hear from people and talk to people. Importantly, I don't think there was anything that came up that really did surprise us. I think we do. understand that there is a lot of we've been facing a lot of challenges, and that, you know, the sort of concerns that are on people's minds, I think they absolutely resonated. There were definitely themes that came up, and they were not a surprise. So I think it had that opportunity to, if you like, make sure we were understanding what was on people's minds. But it was also a really good opportunity to talk about some of the challenges, why they're not overnight fixes, but what actually is going on as well, what has been going on, what is in place, and then where are we going next. So it was, I think it was a good experience overall. Certainly that's what we picked up.
Because it can be that, certainly from my experience anyway, in government, you are talking to other ministers, you understand priorities, and you're trying to move certain things on in your own particular way. And sometimes, particularly after 2.5 years since the general election, it can be difficult to actually get back to what the public are really thinking, and maybe getting back to that kind of raw, actually, government's not really doing what we need.
Well, I think, you know, that it is a good opportunity to reconnect. It was absolutely felt that it was important, actually, to go out and talk to people, listen to them. As I say, I don't think anything was a surprise. And I think we'd already, in the refocusing of the island plan that we debated in March, you know, the six real areas of focus, because I think you're right, Phil, you know, there are many, many, many things that we can tackle, that people would like us to tackle. But actually, if we try and run at absolutely everything, then there's a real danger you don't achieve things. And I think it is important to have that discipline to make sure that the things we prioritise above other things are the things that the vast majority of the public are keen to see progress on. And I think the listening roadshows were a really good opportunity to also make sure that we are having that focus on the areas that matter to most people. And I think that's certainly something that came across to us.
And Claire, I mean, I recall being DEFA minister and begging people to ask me questions, because for whatever reason, DEFA is one of those areas that perhaps people overlook when it comes to asking questions. But I mean, how did you find the sessions, and did anyone ask you some questions?
So I had really good conversations actually on the one-to-ones, and I think people came with lots of different subjects, as you'd expect with DEFA, with the broad scope of areas it covers. But I didn't get any questions on the Q&A, and I think that's, you know, absolutely how it's been historically. I think if we, you know, reflect, the questions were predominantly focused around those areas that are those areas we're prioritising, and, you know, resonated clearly with the people who'd come along to the roadshows. So health, treasury, questions around taxation, as we would have expected, I think, and housing, you know, was very heavily featured. For me, I think that was, you know, absolutely a reaffirming of those positions that we've taken as a council of ministers. And I think, as Jane said, it's absolutely about the need to focus in on the things that we can achieve. But I also think it gave the opportunity to explain some of the things that are happening that perhaps on reflection we're not getting the messaging out well enough. So, you know, just as I think it's important for us to reconnect, it's actually also really helpful to have the opportunity for the people who came along to connect and reconnect with us. And I reflect, and as Douglas East as an example, we've held a number of constituency surgeries and no one's come. And yet when we held this, actually the turnout was, I think, better than we'd anticipated, which for me was really, really good news. And I think we have to reflect on who we're attracting to the roadshows. There was comments that were made around a lack of youth representation. There were some young people who came and some really brilliant contributions from them. But I think it would have been great to have had more people come along. And I think there's opportunities perhaps to pick that up with the Tim Ward Youth Committee and explore that reasoning as to why people aren't engaging in some of the ways that we're choosing to engage, because it's not necessarily they're not engaging, but perhaps the mechanisms we're using just aren't the right ones.
And actually, it was great then that Christian Jones, as we heard earlier in the programme, managed to speak to quite a few younger people, and their testament was quite quite shocking, really, to hear. I know we hear that young people are really struggling to find properties, but certainly what they've said to us, it paints a really quite stark picture.
And I think that was, you know, very much one of the key focuses around conversations and contributions that were had at the events. What's absolutely fundamental then is refocusing. We know we've got the Housing Communities Board, which really talks to a significant number of those issues, but also understanding some of those challenges that are outside of government, things like the mortgage payments. We know people have come at the end of some of the significant interest rates increases. They're now coming to renegotiate mortgages, and they're finding those have gone up significantly. These are all areas that, while government can't change those mortgage rates, what we need to do is look at how we can enable people to have more disposable income to enable them to manage that situation and not find people who simply decide they need to sell the house and leave the island. So I think it's really helpful to understand in a holistic way from some of the contributions that we had, all of those areas, and then it allows us to go away, reflect, look at where we've settled with the island plan and just sense check that. And I think that's absolutely, for me, what this was all about.
Jane, then, do you appreciate, understand the frustration that there is in the community at the moment? I know it's a hard thing being in government and making things happen, but many people are saying we're 2.5 years in, and aside from the glossy reports and the strategies, we're not seeing the level of action that I suppose many people had hoped for at election time.
Well, I think, as Claire said, it was an important opportunity not only to hear from people, but for us to reconnect and talk about what is going on. So the questions I got specifically around the sort of Home Affairs area touched on things like security and, you know, what are we doing to tackle any threats, and that was a really good opportunity to talk about some of the work we're doing now to enhance port security and our entry points to the island. And I think, you know, people have seen the extensive reporting about the fantastic work the Constabulary have been doing to tackle serious and organised crime. But it was a really good opportunity to talk about, well, what are we doing next? You know, we're focusing on working with ports policing so we can have better, more effective operations at the ports, looking at technology solutions, working with partners such as the Steam Packet and so on to look at our passenger verification, and where we need to, we'll pick up any legislative change that we need to make changes around there. So that was a very good opportunity to talk about what has happened, what is happening. And there was also an opportunity to talk about the new sexual offences law that we brought in at the end of March. And, you know, again, to point out what difference that actually makes in terms of new offences, to keep pace with technology and how offending may change, but importantly enhance protection for vulnerable people, particularly children. And I think that particularly resonates with something we've heard this week around child protection and Sarah's Law. So it's a good opportunity to say actually the Isle of Man has got enhanced protection now through that new legislation for the police to be able to put in place protection orders and sexual risk orders, but also that we have enhanced multi-agency public protection arrangements, which is basically the police and the probation services monitoring offenders, both through their custodial time, but also if they are released back into the community. So I think it's that point, as you rightly said, Phil, about helping to get across what has happened, but what a difference it makes in terms of people's lives and directly benefiting the community.
I'm guessing, though, and maybe I'll put this to Claire, when the bright, shiny new Council of Ministers was established and the new Housing and Communities Board was established, you might have thought that there would have been more progress on housing after 2.5 years.
So I think what was interesting was there was also an opportunity for a number of updates from the Housing Communities Board, which Laurie Hooper gave. And we talked about the objective assessment of need. So that's just about to be finalised. And that's starting to give some data that gives some quite interesting figures. So the introduction of an increased rate for people off island purchasing properties or people purchasing second properties for renting has shown that actually 75% of properties being purchased on the island are being purchased by island residents to live in. And I think that's a important piece, because I think there had been some speculation that actually was large numbers of off-island investors. And actually the off-island investors is around 0.5%. It's a tiny number of those people within that cohort. So that allows us to understand a little bit better what we're working on, which definitely indicates the problem is the number of properties we have available. So there was talk around some of the schemes that Treasury are looking at to bring some of the vacant properties back into use. There's also the work that Manx Development Corporation have done with the old nurses' home, specifically looking at a place where key workers will be able to settle immediately on coming to the island. And I think all of those things started to talk about some of the things we're already in train, things that have already happened. You know, that work's been just quietly ticking on the nursing home. And unless you live in the area, you know, I think a number of people probably aren't aware just how progressed that is. But also some of the other projects, you know, the number of planning applications for new houses that are sitting in the application system at the minute, around 650 new builds. So all of that is heading in the right direction. But I suppose with anything, construction doesn't happen immediately. But absolutely all of the work we've done around planning has been with the intention of trying to open that up and allow it to happen while still maintaining a responsible planning system. So I think there is good news in the housing space. And my expectation would certainly be that within the next year, year and a half, we'll start to see some of these houses coming online, with DOI committing to review the mid-rent schemes, committing to look at not just the first-time buyers, but also the second-time buyers and possibly the last-time buyers, because we acknowledge that every part of the market at the current time is in a bit of a lock jam. So actually, if we can resolve some of those issues, free some of those properties up and allow people to go to a property more suited to their size, we should have more units. So there absolutely is work going on. And so it was really great to have the opportunity to share that with members of the audience, in some cases who may not have been aware or may not have been aware of the extent of what's going on. But I absolutely acknowledge the reality is this will be tested in the results. And the people who came along, you know, I hope that we'll get that feedback again through future events of a similar nature where we have that opportunity to engage. But I also hope that perhaps for some people, the opportunity to talk to us one-to-one and realise that actually we are accessible and we are just people living in the community with the same fears and concerns for our own children and our own families and our own parents and our own neighbours and friends. You know, actually we can be approached at any time, and I really would want to get that message out loud and clear. Certainly it's not that we're not accessible, because I have people call me all the time. Email, Facebook, Twitter, you know, I mean, I wish there was just one central place, if I'm honest, because I could coordinate it a little bit better. But, you know, there really are many ways for people to reach out. And I would always say, if people have a query, have an issue, do reach out, whether it be to your local MHK or whether it be to a minister, someone related to that department. We may not always be able to solve the problem immediately, but I can absolutely assure people we take those really seriously and we then feed them into future policy development.
One of the great things that Manx National Heritage has done over the years is produce some excellent presentations at Castle Rushen, one of which has one of the Stanleys teaching us statecraft. Basically, he says, if you've got a rowdy mob, the best thing you can do is listen to them. You don't have to take any notice of them, but at least put over the pretense that you are listening. Is that what's happening here, or are we going to actually see some real change as a result of this listening exercise?
It's absolutely not an exercise in listening without action, Phil. That's as Claire has said, you know, we are part of this community as well. I think I can't think of anyone who goes into this sort of role, and you know, it's highly demanding, but people go into it because they care, because this island matters and we're all part of the community. So it is absolutely vital that we not only listen, but then reflect on what we've heard. Now, what is interesting is I think a lot of what we heard is sort of what we already understood and appreciated, because we do live in this community and our constituents contact us, and anyway, people contact you as the minister in your area to raise particular questions. I think there's a couple of things about really, I suppose, doubling down on the priority areas, which are, as Clara said, you know, housing, for example, is in hand. There are a number of initiatives underway. It's just, I think, sometimes that it's not always as quick as any of us would like. Sometimes it's more complex than we might hope for.
Do we make it too complicated sometimes?
No, I don't think we do. I mean, I think we have had a strong focus. Certainly, I can speak from my perspective, and I think Claire would too, that where there are cross-departmental challenges, so sometimes problems to resolve them, and housing is a very good example of this, they do not neatly fit in one area, and the different aspects that and levers that you might need to change or pull to make some difference cut across more than one department. So I think we've tried very hard actually to be better, and that was one of the reasons for having the Housing and Communities Board, because you need to work across the piece very often to tackle the multiple layers of issue that need to be unpacked and changed in order to make progress. And I think we're all frankly impatient to deliver for people. So no, we're not about making things more complicated than they need to be, but the reality is some things sometimes are complex and they require action on more than one front to actually deliver the outcome. But we are about delivering the outcome, and I think it is about doubling down on progressing to do that. And I think it is about keeping that connection, keeping that communication, so people at least understand, well, why is it that, this initiative around vacant properties, when will this come forward? Why does it take time? So I think it is about that connection, but importantly, it is about showing where we are on that line of progress.
And then final word to you, Claire. What are the next steps? Presumably you've collated all the feedback that you've received, and something is going to happen with that.
Yeah, so I mean, certainly within the departments, we've collated the information we gathered, and some of that's from chief officers, because, certainly in DEFA, we became a bit of a, three of us at one point, because there was a lot of queries. So we've collated that. We've also then gone through and made sure that the people who'd requested information, we've got responses being drawn up so we can go back to them and contact them with the responses. And then what we'll do is we'll anonymise that data and share that centrally with the Cabinet Office team, who are going to pull that together for a paper that council can consider in a more sort of conjoined way, I suppose. And we've acknowledged, obviously, we have to anonymise that. We don't. People who've shared data with DEFA may not want that shared across government, and we don't have those consents. So anyone who's concerned about where their data will go, I just want to give a reassurance on that. And then as council, we'll reflect on those in those themes, looking at the number of people who raise specific issues, but also the impact those areas have, because I always think something I reflect, when people come to me with the problem, something that's bothering them, that's often the thing that's absolutely top of the concerns for them. And it's absolutely important that we reflect and understand that. But then we also have to bear in mind all of the other things that we are recognising are there. And sometimes that's very difficult. And I think the key is communication, articulating to people why that might not be a priority at this point, but also signposting in some cases. So I think the piece of work for us to do, and I don't think it will be hugely difficult, because I think there were some very clear themes that came out. We'll be checking that in terms of its prioritisation against the island plan, and just sense checking if there are some areas that we need to give greater consideration to, certainly in considering the next budget, certainly in looking at the work that we're doing around housing, for example, and also checking that the money that's been put into health, because we know there's been a significant budget uplift this year, is going to the places that are seen as priorities for the community.
That was Deputy Chief Minister and Home Affairs Minister Jane Poole-Wilson and DEFA Minister Claire Barber. We've just got time to squeeze in a short piece Christian Jones recorded at the Southern event with Alex Cowley, a member of Timmel's Youth Select Committee.
You obviously have some involvement within the kind of political workings of the Isle of Man. What's your impression of tonight?
Well, it wasn't what I was expecting. I thought it would be more of a question time type Q&A, but I've heard people say and compare it to speed dating. If you're able to get through to the MHKs, because there are quite a lot of people here as expected, then it is useful, because you're able to have a one-on-one conversation with them about matters that are important to you. But as I say, because there are quite a lot of people here, the format in which the Q&A is going on, it's quite hard to actually be able to speak to an MHK.
You're watching some of the MHKs here and some of the ministers here. Does what they're doing appeal to you?
In some respects, I think for different departments and different ministers, obviously, it's different.
And why do you reckon they are hosting these events?
Well, I think originally with the public, they didn't think they were being heard, especially after the budget. And so I think the government's trying to take action to hear more of the public's voice, which I think they should be doing.
There was much more than I could fit into this week's broadcast programme, so here's some of the bits I couldn't squeeze in. First, Keith Dalrymple from the North.
OK, let's start off by talking about Loonies of Ramsey, which announced its closing yesterday. Chair of Ramsey Commissioners called it a shock. What's your response?
It is a shock, but it's also symptomatic of what is happening in the retail sector on the island. A business like that, that has contributed to the well-being of Ramsey for three generations, disappearing now because, as they've publicly stated, they can't see a way of sustaining it. It's devastating. And the knock-on effect is that other, perhaps less well-established businesses will wonder whether it's worth the fight for them to continue. It's a big challenge, but it's part of the conundrum that we have to address. Our town centres are dying. There's no simple answer. It's been attempted in so many places to address retail decay, but an answer has to be found.
Tonight you've spoken quite passionately about a number of issues, including polarisation between the public and private sector. Can you just briefly describe what the issue is in that area?
The issue is that the Isle of Man has limited resources, limited finite resources of expertise, of finance, of time. And all of those resources should be harnessed to the best interest of the whole of the island, not an adversarial situation where the public sector treats the private sector as the enemy and the private sector waits for the next attack from the public sector.
Do you have confidence that Comyn will go away and do what these series of events have been about, which is listening?
Oh, I believe the Chief Minister is listening and has been listening for a while. And I believe that he is passionate about delivering those laudable aspirations within his island plan. Whether they are deliverable will rest with his colleagues and the other departments around him. He cannot do it alone as Chief Minister. He was talking about unifying the Isle of Man. He is basically attempting to operate a coalition government of disparate ideological, political ideals. And it's a juggling act for him. I hope he's successful because the whole island needs it.
Do you think that because the political system is vastly independent, there's not a lot of party politics, do you think that that plays to the detriment of productivity?
It must do, because we've seen outspoken independent politicians whose careers have been ended because people didn't like anybody who was outspoken or a little too robust. The independents that we have, if you become familiar with them and their political leanings, you'll realise that they're not independently minded. We do have a Manx Labour Party, we do have Lib Vannan, we had two wings of Manx nationalism for a long time, but we don't have a right-wing Conservative Party. I would say that Tynwald has moved steadily to the left. Every successive Tynwald since the end of the Second World War has moved successively to the left, and we've arrived at this point where even the left-wing persuaded politicians are having to acknowledge that the Isle of Man has to cut its cloth. We heard mention of entitlement. Entitlement? When we arrive on Earth at birth, all we're entitled to is God's given free air. Everything else is given by mankind and can be taken away by mankind as easily. So I'm more interested in responsibilities than entitlements.
And here's some initial reaction from Ministers Hooper and Allenson, followed by the Chief Minister.
Across the roadshows, we've seen housing as one of the hot topics. You are on the Housing and Communities Board. Do you think that housing is as big of an issue as people make out?
I think the short answer to that is yes. There are some real challenges with housing on the island. So if you talk to some estate agents, for example, they'll say that actually purchasing is lots of properties out there that are for sale. The question then becomes, are they affordable for people, those particular properties? You know, they're for sale at all ends of the spectrum. And then you talk to people trying to rent, and renting is also a challenge on the island because there aren't enough rental properties. But ultimately, it all seems to boil down to the demand out there is greater than the supply. So there are more people that are looking to buy or to rent than there are actual properties available to buy or to rent, which is why the island plan target is actually to start increasing the number of homes that are occupied, which involves building or converting, you know, to actually make sure there are more properties available on the island, because it really does feel like it's a supply issue.
And the OAHN is a document which is due to be published soon, and that looks at the island's housing need. Just in basic terms, what does that document actually hope to achieve?
So it's called an objective assessment of housing need, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It is a piece of work that's been conducted that is quite detailed, that talks around the current need for housing on the island and the likely forecast future need. So especially in line with the island plan ambition to grow the workforce by 5,000 people. Clearly, they're going to need somewhere to live. Clearly, Manx people that are living here that want to move out from their parents' home, or old people who would like to downsize their property perhaps as they're nearing retirement. There's all sorts of dimensions to the housing challenges we're facing. But the OAHN, as you said, the OAHN, is aiming at trying to put some numbers around that, put some data behind it, and hoping, what we're hoping to do is when that's published, is to be able to start folding some of that data then into things like the island strategic plan or the island plan targets to say, well, actually, how many public sector houses do we think we need to build? You know, what's the property mix look like? Is it more flats? Is it more bungalows? Is it supported living? Is it a residential home? What is it that we actually need to be looking at developing on the island, and where, in order to meet some of our current housing need, but also the future housing need that we know is coming down the line? So it's about long-term planning. It's not just about fixing today's problem. It's about saying, let's stop this problem getting worse, and let's make sure that as we go and as we grow as an island, that actually we've got affordable housing for everybody.
And just last question, affordability and access are two areas that people have spoken about. There have been some concerns raised about foreign investment, but you've given some interesting statistics about the housing market in its current state.
Yeah, so back in 2021, 22, we changed the rules around land registration. So when you buy a property, the amount of money you've got to pay. And there's different fees now. So there's a fee for an owner-occupier, that's someone who wants to buy a house to live in it as their main house worldwide. And there's other fees for people who want to buy a property to rent out. And there's another fee for foreign investors, if you're an off-island person buying a property. And so now we know, of all the transactions that have happened in the last 2 years since 2022, who's buying these properties and what for. And it turns out that the land registry data shows that 75% of those transactions, 75% of house purchases, have been owner-occupiers. That's people that are on the Isle of Man who live in this property as their main residence. So that's 75 people of homeowners, basically. The other 25% will be people buying for investment reasons, probably to rent out. But of all of those properties, the amount that have actually paid the foreign tax, the foreign investor charge, is only 0.2%. So that's 2 in every 1,000 transactions have been somebody off-island buying an investment property on the island. And so really the anecdotal evidence that you hear kind of from people out and about, that there's this feeling that there's lots of foreign pressure on the housing market. It doesn't seem that that's the case, actually. The last couple of years, the real pressure on the housing market is people buying houses to live in them, which is ultimately what we want people to do, buy houses to live in them. There is a challenge, I think, that was raised in Peel when we were talking about these numbers. And we talked a bit about the fact we also need a vibrant rental market on the island, because one of the challenges we're facing is finding somewhere for people to rent a property that's affordable for them. You know, when they move here, when they move out of home, wherever it is, even for a short term. But there are people that want to rent longer term. Not everybody wants to buy a house. And so there's a conversation which I think we need to have now as a parliament, as a government, to say, well, you know, do we need to have more rental properties on the island? I think the answer to that is yes, to bring prices down. But also that means we need to build more properties, because if there is this pressure on people who are trying to buy houses, and that's what's causing the housing demand. Clearly, we need more properties for people to buy that are affordable for them. So it's a complex picture on housing, but I think some of the data we've got is able to dispel some of those myths that you might hear out there.
When I first entered this room, it was what I can only describe as you being swarmed by people. Was that surprising to you?
No, I think you're wrong there. I wasn't being swarmed by people. There were a lot of people interested in talking about financial matters with me, and also the Chief Financial Officer. And what we've had tonight is a really good, constructive listening exercise, listening to a whole range of issues that have been brought forward by a really well-attended meeting. So it's not a matter of swarming. We've had lots of people here, lots of different viewpoints being expressed and lots of different concerns being expressed. And what our role in terms of the ministers here is to listen and to take on board people's concerns, to explain what the Isle of Man government are doing at the moment in terms of delivering on the Isle of Man plan and the economic strategy, and then to work with people in terms of achieving what we want for our island.
And what sort of people were approaching you? Was that mostly like businesses, or was it individuals too?
It was a range of people. So what we've tried to do is one-to-one sessions. So I know you reported that as being like a parents' evening. It certainly wasn't like any parents' evening I've been to. So I had people talking about state pensions for women and the changes that have taken place with that and how we would respond to the stuff going on in the UK. We talked also to people from business about things like VAT, the pressures on the hospitality sector at the moment in terms of increasing wages. Talked a lot about the minimum wage increases and the living wage, but also about energy prices and the way that they are starting to come down now. We've mentioned utilities bringing a 5.1% decrease in this month and with a 16% decrease in Manx gas in January. So trying to paint the picture that we've gone through an extremely difficult period over the last 18 months with high inflation, high costs. Lots of businesses and individual people have had to absorb those costs. Government have had to absorb those costs. But now we're in a slightly different position of trying to look at how we have a sustainable boost for our economy and actually can build on what we have on the island now right across the public and private sector.
Let's just come to VAT, which you just mentioned there. I know there have been calls recently for an overhaul of that system. I've seen figures like 5% floated. What would that actually do to Treasury's reserves if that was to actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, what we're doing at the moment, and you've been, Max Radio have been very good at reporting it, is going through household income and expenditure surveys, also the business surveys that are going on, because this year we renegotiate the VAT sharing agreement with the United Kingdom. That's done every 5 years. Now, I'm speaking in Tynwald this week about the significance of VAT, particularly in terms of the hospitality sector. So VAT brings in 28% of government's income, which is then spent on things like health, education. A 1% cut just in terms of the hospitality sector would lead to a reduction in £2.5 million in terms of income for government. So it's a significant amount there, which we recognise. VAT is value-added tax. It's a tax that people providing goods and services add to their bill, collect it on behalf of government, and then pay in. And one of the issues that we were talking about tonight with the hospitality sector is the ability for them to absorb some of the increased costs while still paying VAT. And what we need to do is sit down with that sector, understand the pressures they face, and that's why Minister Johnson and myself will be meeting with the LVA next week to actually listen, to work constructively with people together to create a sustainable way we can meet some of the challenges they face, but also build for the future and look forward to what I hope will be a really good tourism season this year.
A lot of the issues that we've heard tonight, the baseline comes down to funding, and obviously you're the person who allocates the funds to the relevant departments each year through the budget. How tough is it for you to hear some of the concerns raised by residents, but know there's only so far you can ever go?
Yeah, the main impetus of the renewed island plan is that fiscal responsibility, that what government have to do is provide value for money. We do not take for granted VAT, income tax, any of those things we raise to actually provide the frontline services, but we have to do it in as an efficient a manner as possible. And so some of the comments today were about using new technologies, digitalization, AI, to provide better, more effective, more productive public services. And that's what this administration is absolutely committed to doing. It is tight with their household budgets, business budgets and national budget to get to meet all the different priorities we've got. But by working together, I'm absolutely confident we can achieve that.
We've finished the final Comyn Roadshow. How do you feel they've all gone?
I think generally they've been a success in terms of the engagement that's happened, the amount of people that have turned up, the levels of questions that have come through and the challenge that has been put in front of us, the listening that has been done, the opportunities for the one-to-ones. I certainly don't recall this such an extensive engagement piece from government over such a compacted period of time. And certainly, you know, I personally had a huge amount of value from this, and I know the ministers had, and there'll be a lot for us to reflect on in the next, you know, few weeks, and not only in the next few weeks, but I think, you know, these are not short-term turnaround measures, but we need to think carefully about, you know, how things have been taken forward. But it's also been a chance for us to explain our position, and I hope people have also perhaps come away with some understanding, perhaps of the greater challenges that are being faced, but also the our view that we need to keep pushing forward for a better, secure, more sustainable and vibrant future. So listen, a lot to take away.
And just one last question. A lot of the issues which were raised throughout all of the events don't appear to be quick fixes. Do you think the public is receptive to that now?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, I think the issues that we've got, some of the build-up of problems, if that's the right word, or waiting lists and things in the health service, some of our CAMHS waiting lists for children and mental health problems, and how we take and tackle those really need to be probably more clearly defined. I hope the public have, you know, who've been here and have had that chance to engage, at least have heard how we are tackling those issues, where the money has gone when we've invested it and are investing it into health, and what we're actually going to do with it. But as I say, you know, you have to get a balance right as well in the economy, and we need to be striking the balance between people having those, that economic freedom, if you like, in the choices themselves, and having the competitive economy versus clearly the way that we are tackling the delivery of services to solve some of the problems that we have as a society. And also, of course, within that, we need to keep building a united society. And it's one of my big passions that, you know, this sort of view of one nation together. So we do need to do more in our communication, both ways, really, in terms of economic growth, successful economic growth, versus how and when we need to take money from the public through taxation, and how it's being applied in terms of our focus for public services.
Finally, I asked Manx Radio's Christian Jones for his reaction to the listening events. You were at all four of the Comin road shows. What was the official title of them?
It was the Listening to You events.
Listening to You. So did they listen to us?
They definitely appeared to be listening. I'm not entirely sure that the ministers were quite ready for some of the questions, especially towards the beginning of the week. There were some questions over things like assisted dying, which is obviously a private member's bill and not actually a Comin-related piece of work. So they weren't ready for those questions, and I suppose they were not quite sure how to deflect those questions because they couldn't actually answer them. And that didn't go down as well in the first sitting, the first event, because people thought that it's law, they're something to do with law, they should be able to answer it. And I think towards the end of the road shows, they became increasingly more transparent and candid. I think they were ready for some of the questions that they were going to be asked. Castle Russian High School, which was the first one, was almost like the test. They weren't quite sure what was going to be thrown at them. In many ways, I suppose it's like a live man in line, except you've got someone standing up and shouting at you instead. But towards the end, the one in the north, they were probably the most candid they've been. They were taking very strong criticism about them, and they were actually giving some quite considered responses.
Because, of course, in terms of assisted dying, it is a private member's bill. It's deemed to be a vote of conscience when it comes to the House of Keys. But, of course, there is a government-related element to this, in as much as the people who are going to do this, if the assisted dying bill does make it through the branches and get royal assent, are the government. You know, it's Manx Care will be left with having to implement the policy. And maybe that's something that, on the one hand, people don't necessarily understand the difference between the Keys and government. But on the other hand, maybe government doesn't realise that they can't just say, actually, nothing to do with us, that's a House of Keys matter.
And that was something which they brought up throughout, was that they need to get better at communication. And I think I spoke to Andrew Smith towards the end, and he also said that they have to be more aware of how they're communicating. There was one point where Laurie Hooper spoke about the Cummel Moore situation, and we know what happened there. There was an initial miscommunication from Manx Care, is what he said, and that caused some quite ruffled feathers. So that's effectively what they were trying to get at, was they have to be more open about when they run into stumbling blocks and why they've run into stumbling blocks and what they're going to do about them.
Because that was a big issue, wasn't it? They effectively, announcement was made that the home was closing and there wasn't a replacement, which I can imagine ruffled feathers would be the least of the ways you could have put it.
Absolutely, yes. So, I mean, when the health minister stood up to talk about that, he made it very clear that actually that was a miscommunication on Manx Care's part, and basically collectively Comyn just have to get better at communicating with people, less of the deflection, less of the political answers, and treat the residents how they deserve to be treated effectively and tell them how it is, because they are the ones that are spending the taxpayers' money.
So in terms then of the, I mean, the format obviously evolved, because initially, I mean, it was described in various ways, like parents' evening or speed dating at the first session. I kind of see why government would want to do it that way, because the hardest thing in the world in terms of engaging with the public is through a public meeting, you know, because inevitably a few voices tend to dominate. You don't always get a full and fair reflection of the opinion of the room from those sorts of meetings, because the people who speak tend to be the people who have the confidence to speak. So I kind of get that they would want to do the one-to-ones, but I don't think they could really get away with assuming that they would just be able to do one-to-ones without the full public meeting as well.
And the confidence aspect is exactly what the Chief Minister spoke to me about when I asked him why that setup was the one that was being pursued. He said that some people might have a burning question, but they're not confident enough, like you say, to stand up. And I mean, it can be nerve-wracking standing up in front of lots of people. There are approximately 100 people at each event, and you're effectively telling the whole room in front of a room of strangers what your problem is, which makes you very vulnerable. So I think once they'd refined that speed dating process, if we're going to call it that, the first night it was very much they were just standing. You could just try and walk up to them, but it was difficult to approach them. People were kind of crowded around them. The second, third and fourth night, it was a more civilized approach, if that's the right word. They were sat at tables and you could go and sit down at the table and have a chat with them instead.
So in terms then of the whole process, council of ministers made themselves available, they listened. Were there any indications as to what happens next? Because of course it's very easy to listen and then crack on regardless. And were there any indications from the Chief Minister, from Comyn, that the listening process was going to be a proper listening process and real change would come as a result?
So when I spoke to the Chief Minister towards the end, he said that it was a two-way street, these listening to events. It was an opportunity for them to hear the actual concerns on the street from the everyday person, but also gave them an opportunity to tell them what they're already doing or what's in the works to be able to try and rectify that. And Alfred kind of made it very, very blatantly obvious that these things are not quick fixes. The housing issue, which was brought up throughout the entire string of road shows, the health service, getting GP appointments, getting dentist appointments. A lot of these things are not quick fixes, which is what he said. And so he did say they've got a lot to go away and think about. But he also says that the public have to effectively understand that they are in a position where they have to reinstill financial discipline, is the words that he used. And we know that the government finances have been attacked by COVID and not helped with the recent cost of living. So that's what he was trying to put across, is they want to do all of these different things, but it's going to take time and that it's not going to be a quick fix.
Did the sessions reflect what ministers often dismiss as negative chatter on social media by anonymous posters? Did the actual, the real people that were there seem to reflect that, well, negativity or perhaps anxiety and concern for the future of the island?
Whilst I was speaking to some of the attendees before the Q&A session, there were a lot of genuine, like, passionate concerns about things. People were genuinely worried about what they're going to do with their next paycheck, how they're going to afford to live, whether they've got any prospects on the island. So I think that it's very easy for you, for anyone, to sit on social media and type away. But obviously, as we know, when you type on social media, same with sending a text to people, that context of the actual meaning behind your words is lost. So what you might see as extremely negative and someone attacking you on social media might be their way of trying to get your attention. So we did see some very strongly worded questions. Some people were questioning whether the public can have trust in the government and what they're going to do to rectify that. The Council of Ministers seems to be receptive to those concerns. They've heard themselves be called out on social media. I think they do appear to be aware of the issues and what people think of them, but I suppose that is why they hosted these events, which was, as the Deputy Chief Minister said, was to try and rebuild those relationships with the public.
And finally, if in a year or so's time we're talking about this event, how confident would you say you are that there will be real change as a result of what happened over the course of the last week?
Well, it was interesting you say that, because I spoke to Keith Dalrymple, who is obviously the chair of the Northern Chamber of Commerce. We've seen businesses close, a lot of them, over the last few months, over the last years, and most of them have cited financial pressures. When I spoke to Mr. Dalrymple, he said that he is confident that the Chief Minister does want to make change and he does want to listen, but he's got the task of effectively running a coalition government, because we have majority of the elected political members are independents. There's not a lot of party politics. So he thinks that the challenge for him will be trying to bring all of these politicians on side who've got their own visions, own ideas, and trying to tell them this is the right one is going to be the biggest challenge for him.
That was Christian Jones from Manx Radio, who attended all four of the Listening to You Council of Ministers roadshows. So what do you think? Will the ministers shift course, having heard from the public, or will they revert back to their original plan, secure in the comfort of the Tynwald bubble? It was certainly a brave initiative from Council of Ministers to find out what the people think in such a very open and public way. Perhaps Perspective will revisit this exercise next year to see how, if at all, the public voice influenced government's actions. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Gunamayus and Geishakram. Thanks for listening.